Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I am your host, Nick Shutt. Happy to have my friend Anoop Mahendale here with me today. Anoop, how are you, sir?
Doing well. It's a great morning. Weather's still holding up pretty here in our area.
Absolutely. It's the end of August right now, and it's supposed to be like 104, 110 degrees outside in the DC area, but man, it's like 75 out, and it's making me not want to work. I'm not gonna lie to you, Noob. I just kind of want to go out and do stuff, you know?
Yeah, I mean, not working is having a nice chat with you, Nick.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely, 100%, man. So, dude, for everybody that doesn't have the opportunity to know you yet, Noob, do you mind telling folks a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here, man?
Love to. I've been living in this area in Northern Virginia area for the last 9 years, but prior to that, I grew up in India. I was an engineer, got my MBA because I thought that would be a path to doing more entrepreneurial things. I mean, kind of like turns out it's much more of a path to being in management than in just necessarily entrepreneurial stuff. But it was still a very good education and one of the top schools. Coming out of that, I helped build up a R&D center for a very different business from healthcare, which we're going to talk about today. So I helped build a R&D center for a company called Daimler Chrysler, which was an aggregation of, which was, I think, at that point, a fifth largest company in the world. And it was an aggregation of the Mercedes-Benz brands in Germany, Chrysler, Mitsubishi, a bunch of truck brands. So it was a big auto company. And the idea was that there was a big demographic shift happening to Asia. And to kind of front run that, the idea was to build up some R&D capacity and do things like even things like LiDAR, which at that time was like very, very out there into the future sort of R&D. But it turns out like that's what Waymo's using, Tesla's not using, that kind of stuff. Yeah, so it was really cool things. But I think out of that, what I gathered was there was some low-hanging opportunity around lots of data that was being captured across the world. This was 2006, 7 time frame, so they had a lot of data, but the analytical capabilities were very sort of like very nascent at that point, and that helped like me think about creating a startup around just doing that, which is like going in like kind of like think of it as McKinsey style management consulting, but everything driven by internal data that companies already have. So we would go in and say, look, you already have tons of data, and there's so many business problems that you can optimize or kind of solve. Why don't we analyze that data for you and provide data-driven solutions and consulting? So that was kind of a services business, but there was a lot of demand for it, and we built up a pretty interesting business, which eventually went IPO in 2022. But I left at some point and joined another startup that was, probably at that point better funded, with eventually Sequoia Capital and these kind of big VCs. And with that, I moved to the US, did a lot of work in the healthcare space, building up a big analytical team for prescription data for one of the big players. And then from there, I went on to kind of start another startup. And then eventually, because of my kind of requirements to have a visa and apply for a green card, it turns out that I had, it was kind of better for me to be in a larger corporation. So I joined, I was taking a bit of a break from the entrepreneurial ventures. And my son was kind of like, was due. My wife was pregnant with our son. So I was like, okay, let me take it a bit easy. So we moved to Pittsburgh. I worked at a big Blue Cross Blue Shield company called Highmark, did some really innovative, interesting, kind of technology work in healthcare on the insurance side. And that was my real, like, deep dive into healthcare. And then from there, I was, and I can talk about some of the things we did there, but I think at a overall a high level, kind of did things like acquiring hospitals, and kind of merging them with the insurance arm. To whatever extent regulators would allow. And then also launched a platform for kind of creating other plans. There's a lot of data stuff there as well. And then kind of launched a private exchange, went to Aetna then after that, Aetna was still independent at that point, trying to buy Humana. So I was helping with the M&A work there. And from there, kind of moved to DC area for a company called Advisory Board, which is one of the leading health, I would say, healthcare consulting and technology companies, but with the focus on hospitals. So we worked with close to 5,000 hospitals across the country. So knew really, really had like we had really good relationships, and I knew a lot of the C-suite. We're building some new products for them using our network. And then at that point, it got bought by UnitedHealth Group's Optum. So I was part of Optum, which is also a great experience, including some time at Optum Life Sciences, where we basically, I mean, this is kind of getting kind of closer to the topic that we're talking about, where there was a business within Optum where we would assemble data from EHR systems, the electronic health record systems, which are maintained by the hospitals, and then the claims data, that is, claims that are submitted by various providers to insurance companies, and then put them together at the de-identified individual level, and then offer that as a syndicated data set for pharmaceutical research. Right, so we had 120 million lives, longitudinal data set across 10, 20 years. So it's pretty interesting stuff. But I mean, so that's when I kind of cut my teeth with data. And then after that, I was briefly at Salesforce before I started my own startup, when I finally got my green card. And that startup was in the AI space. And even though I was wondering what I should do, whether I should go towards a particular sector of the industry. As it happened, I had a lot of friends in healthcare, and I got dragged back into healthcare, and they were like, "Oh, can you do some AI work for health payers?" And so that's what I ended up doing, built a business around the third-party administrator business, the payer business, for making their administrative work much easier, but also at the same time gather some of the critical data that the industry was missing, and become kind of a premier source of that data as well, alongside what we were doing on the AI automation side of things.
No, man, that's fantastic. Beautiful. I mean, that's a huge, huge career. A lot, you touched a lot of different things. And yeah, at what point did you move into like AI and AI specifically? And also, I'm really curious, having grown up in another country, having grown up overseas, what are your impressions of the US medical system, and what were they when you started, and kind of how has that changed over time?
So let me take the second part of your question first. So I would say, for me, I mean, US healthcare was very, very unusual, because I would travel in different countries. I didn't need too much healthcare, but growing up, I mean, I wasn't keeping too well. So I've experienced the healthcare system in a different country. So when I came here, I was very surprised to understand how on one hand it's how organized it is, but on the other hand, how kind of completely disparate and split up the experience was, and also kind of didn't realize how expensive it was relative to any other country. So all of these were like shocks to me. I think I still feel like the overall outcomes are reasonably good, but I mean, obviously there are many, many statistics which show that. Within the OECD, for example, US is not in the top at all. So I think there are many, many places where it's not doing well. But I mean, in the global scheme of things, it's fine. But when you look at how much the money is being spent, and if you look at the developed countries sort of benchmark, it's definitely a huge issue here in the US. But that also kind of told me that there's a lot of opportunity. Right, so from a business perspective, or from a AI or data perspective, there's going to be a lot of opportunity. So that was kind of like my impression coming in. And then I think from your question around AI, I mean, I think when we did those analytics startups, we used to do a lot of AI work. But like we would basically do a little bit of machine learning sort of stuff. But when it came to generative AI kind of work, where you have transformer models or models which are black box in nature inherently, where it's non-deterministic black box results. We would generally keep away from that. I mean, we would do it, but just for our own sort of internal understanding. But when you present it to a customer, we would never want to show that because they would say, "Well, how did you come up with this?" And we have an explanation, right? Like we can say, "Yeah, the model gave it to us," but that's no use for executive decision makers who want to have a good rationale as to why something was done. We try to kind of steer away from it, but like it's only when ChatGPT 3.5 came out, like I was like, okay, now this is getting really mature to a point where even though it's still like black box in nature, it actually produces useful output that can be used for its own purposes rather than having to explain how it happened. So the explanation became less important and the output became more important. And that's when I started Xficient, right? So that kind of inspired me to say, yeah, now it's ready, where we can build some, business around it. This is 2023, right? So it's still early days, but at least gave me the confidence.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously through when 3.5 came out, that was game changing. It went from, nobody was really talking about AI in the mainstream, and then all of a sudden, I want to say end of 22, everybody was like, end of 22, beginning of 23, everybody was like, yeah, this news article, it sounds like I wrote it, but it was actually written by ChatGPT. It's like, guys, that's a great way to show that it can actually do stuff, but it really has been fundamentally changing, game changing from a it being in consumers' hands, I think. I think that's been like the huge change, is that it's accessible now. And I think that like it's really cool that, frankly, with all these, LLMs, and other, agentic solutions out there, that essentially we as consumers have access to the most powerful computers in the world, which has been really cool. Have you seen, how has that, experience recently, like, contrasted with some of the more legacy, like, healthcare apps that you've worked with, or healthcare data and like in the consumer apps that you've worked with?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question because I mean I was about to say like when you said consumers like the feature of the consumer market is that one consumers are very forgiving, right? Like you make mistakes and they're like, I don't care, I'll use if it's useful. If not, I'll move on and do something else. So that's the nature of the consumer market. But also like because you can price it so low, like it's $20 a month sort of subscription. People are like, for $20, I don't mind if a few things don't work out, right? So they're again very forgiving because of the price point as well. And on the flip side, for the companies, I mean, $20, if they get a mass adoption, it's still a lot of money, right, on an annual basis for when you have millions of users. I think that was the perfect sort of like I guess serendipity or whatever you want to call it, but it just happened to be the perfect solution for what that market was. But then bringing that into the enterprise world is always difficult, right? Because enterprise customers are not going to be as forgiving, right? Like in fact, they're paid to get it right every time, right? If you get it wrong a few times, then they're not doing their job basically. So there is going to be a lot more scrutiny, a lot more emphasis on getting it right reliably, and I think that's where like the issues are right now with generative AI in general. But I mean, to your question, I think your question was more around like how do you see like data that how was the old approach in the enterprise world versus like using this? And I think it's a very profound question because if you look at the old way of doing things, everything had to be data driven. Like when anything related to analytics or machine learning or even like early forms of AI, if you want to call it. I mean, AI is a broader bucket, obviously, but like if you want to say non-machine learned AI techniques, everything was very much data driven, and data driven meaning like they had to have curated like data sets that would take a long time to kind of put together and then try to predict a certain pattern. So some data scientist had to notice that pattern and say, okay, this pattern is repeatable and useful. Now let's institutionalize it. Let's put it into software. Let's make it available to a bunch of people within the enterprise. So that was the general approach to kind of any kind of AI, and that's obviously slow and expensive and limited, right? Versus now, I think with generative AI kind of opening the door for a lot of things, they're like, okay, can we do a lot more of it? Like because you have inferences, you can just get inference from like these I would say the public AI companies, right, the foundation companies. But then once you get that inference, you can deploy it in a big way. And there would be more consumer-like use cases sometimes within the enterprise. So to that extent, like for example, trying to write marketing copy, you can take your chances and then you still review it, but you need like that idea generation sort of aspect of it. So you want to use it that way. And there are many other things like writing a proposal, for example. Like there are lots of places where I think that consumer-like mindset is going to come into play. In other places, it's not, right? So where it's not coming into play, I think people are still expecting kind of like the old reliability, like they're used to from a kind of a data-driven sort of approach that they've been traditionally using, and kind of feeling a little disappointed. But I think there are, we can talk about it, but there are ways forward where, I honestly think we should have like a bit of an insurance sort of model where we should expect the model to make mistakes to a certain extent. And then what we should be guaranteeing is the outcome, right? And as long as you guarantee, not even guaranteeing, but you're paying for the outcome. So if there are a few misses, that's okay, because the ones that actually work are still less expensive and more valuable than if you didn't do anything and you just waited for like the ideal machine learning model to have been developed.
Mean, I would agree with you with a caveat that I think that the caveat is it depends on what the model is actually predicting, right? I think that there are some cases where like there absolutely are, listen, it's never going to be perfect and that's going to be okay sometimes, but there's going to be other times where that's not, right? Like, I spoke about I had somebody on a couple of months ago. I had Chris Teixeira on from MITRE, and we were talking about how models change over time, and if you don't continue to retune them, like the results can, even if it was perfect, it won't be later because you're not continuing to retune it. He brought up an example where somebody was using a county was using a machine learning model to determine whether or not for child protective services to determine whether or not or help determine whether or not people children should be like removed from a dangerous situation with family members. And there were a couple of children that he brought up that the model said that they should not be removed, and their parents ended up killing them. And like that's something where we absolutely need to be perfect, right? And there can't be, but I think also you need to have somebody super involved there.
I'll challenge that to some extent, right? I mean, I get what you're saying, and I agree with you overall. But with that, like, we can use that example that you gave me, which seems like an extreme example, and let's see if we can challenge it and push the boundaries on that. The way I would push the boundaries on that is saying, so there are things like, false positives and false negatives, right? So we got to look at like you got to put a risk management lens to all of this, right? So if you're saying, look, if we have a process where even if like you get like let's say you want to get child protective services, there are situations where the model like misses out on situations where like there was a real need for child protective services. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have issues where someone is like falsely sort of like clubbed into that, and that is no need for that sort of intervention. And as long as you kind of understand like what the risk dynamics are and what the review process is for each one of them, there are still ways in which you could probably kind of leverage these models to get to that sort of like interim list much faster. And then you have a different process. The process may be very different because now you know that like this includes things which have like both these sort of things happening. And then your review process is focus purely on eliminating those two, right? So you still say, in my view, I mean, if again, depends on the particular process. So I don't know this process, right? But I'm using this as a construct to say, if you have processes now which are just focused on removing those kind of like false positives or false negatives, then it maybe still be efficient compared to like the perfect machine learning model, which again, there's not going to be perfect. You're going to have this problem anyway. So you might as well embrace it and say, okay, look, this is the inherent problem with these models, but we're going to build a process around it. So I think the beings are taking a very different lens to it on top of it rather than kind of relying on it.
Should be, right? And I think also part of it, to your point, is building a process around the results and making sure that there are For lack of a better term, there's a human involved in the decision-making process. And I also think one of my concerns is, like, and this is just not specific to healthcare or this, but at a broader level about these is going to be, as these models continue to be in consumers' hands, it's going to be over-reliance on them and oh and trusting and oh and trusting it too much, right? And trusting the results too much. Because and I think that is an issue for that's a human issue, not a machine issue, right? But you also, we need to be looking at, because there are going to be failures and there's going to be system failures, or I mean hallucinations, whatever you want to call them. People need to be looking at these, like looking at the results and the output, in a highly scrutinized way. Like I never send anything out without, like, has been AI generated without reviewing it, going through it with a fine tooth comb to make sure, because I know that it's going to fail and I know that it's going to make stuff up. So, I think that's super, super important. But, we also just need to be cognizant and aware of the fact that these, they're never going to be perfect. But it's a tool, but it's also like, it's a tool you shouldn't like over rely on. And there should be processes built, business processes built around the results and scrutinizing the output.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I think I would add one more thing, which is benchmarks, right? So people have made a big deal about AI benchmarks in Silicon Valley and other places for kind of these consumer models or like broader horizontal models. But I feel like, not only I feel it, but I've seen a lot of other people like suddenly kind of realize that, look, we need to have these benchmarks which are very task specific or industry specific and function specific. And like there's not enough work that's being done to kind of create those benchmarks and use those benchmarks against emerging models, because the reality is there's going to be newer and newer models that will keep coming. There are going to be new techniques which will reduce all of these problems. Like, we're not at the end of like our journey on AI by any means, right? So like the way to handle this like long term is to have these right benchmarks figured out right now and use those benchmarks to kind of like say, okay, like what kind of human process you need to have on top of it. Like if the benchmark is, again, it should be very nuanced, right? It should say like, hey, how many false positives are you getting? How many false negatives are you getting? Like that could be one part of the benchmark. The other benchmark could be, something more qualitative, right? For example, or you might want to say like, hey, if it's like a needle in the haystack sort of problem, like are you finding that one thing that's so interesting? There's a benchmark around that, right? Like, so for example, like, maybe not child protective services, some other, let's take some other example, but like all you're trying to find is this one anomaly that's happening within a large data set. The benchmark for that is very different. The models for that is very different, right? So I think everything has to be driven off of use case based benchmarks is kind of push here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, and I agree with you. I think that it's also, to your point, use case and specific, right? Like, I think these large models are great for consumers, but when you start getting into like very specific functions like organizations, like obviously you're going to be building custom solutions around that. You don't need access, like you don't need all the data from all the internet to go in and do some small things. You can have small models in place, and I think that that's probably good for, we probably need those, and that's probably a great approach.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of interest in small models these days. And I think initially the thinking was like, like there's no advantage to having smaller models because the big models are going to overwhelm them anyway and they're going to be cheap enough. But I think now the big models are getting so big that like, the definition of small models has changed. So I think it's ripe for a relook because what would be considered a reasonably large enough model in the past is now considered a small model. And that may be actually perfect for what you're trying to do, right? And if we can like, and I think like, cost for running that locally is reduced quite a bit, especially the distilled models, like, you can do a lot with it. And then you can fine tune and customize it as well, right? Like, so I think there's going to be a lot of thinking around like, how can you freeze certain models and have them be used locally? I mean, the extreme case of this is NVIDIA trying to kind of have some of these models at the chip level, right? Like, but they would split it up into like, very specific models for doing specific things. That's when, it would make sense for them to scale it up and have it on a chip. But I think the next level version is like, in a big enterprise with a steady business focus, it may make sense to have some of these models. But even for those models, I think if you don't have the benchmark, you don't know what you're really looking for, right?
Absolutely. No, but I mean that's everywhere, right? If you don't define your need and define what you're actually what you need and what you're looking for, then you're just gonna be throwing stuff at a wall and seeing and hoping something sticks, right? So it's always about figuring out the result and who you want to talk to and then moving back, or the problem you want to solve and then moving backwards from there. Because otherwise it's like getting into your car and driving without knowing where you're going, right? Like you're gonna get somewhere, but like if you don't know where you're going, like first it's gonna be not the most efficient way. You're not gonna know what success looks like, right? It's just, it's you're just driving, right? Which is sometimes the point for people, but that's neither here nor there.
That's funny.
Yeah, man. So you, when we think about healthcare, right? So I obviously I know you've done a whole lot in it, and I know that the thing that really sparked me wanting to have you on was the new CMS program that was announced, want to say in the last couple of weeks. I don't remember how long ago it was, where their talk where the I think it's CMS is trying to build a unified medical records for every individual person in the country. Is that right?
Yeah, so I think it's a White House initiative that was announced, but I think it's going to be coordinated or managed by CMS. I don't know exactly the level of involvement that CMS is going to have. Is it at the level of like coordination and regulation, or is it like actually housing and managing the data that's actually pulled in physically from some of these sources? So I think some of the details are still sort of hazy from what I've seen in the announcement. But yes, there is definitely CMS involved, the White House pushing for it. And I think kind of like it goes with, I mean, I was talking to a colleague of mine about it, and I think they were like, the thinking was that it's very much in line with like a technology first, private sector first sort of like approach. Because what's happened is in HHS more broadly, I think there's a lot, a lot less people involved right now, like as internal staff, if you will. So with other functions and other areas of HHS, there's a movement where, and I was at some conferences, policy-related conferences. What I'm hearing is that they want industry to self-regulate or have some sort of like, industry-led sort of pushes because they don't have internal staff to sit and kind of, babysit, if you will. If you want to say it kindly, on the other hand, like, if you're much more of a, kind of like, oh, we need to have like government kind of play the role of, sort of like setting the standards and running that sort of objective thing, then maybe they'll say you're understaffed, right? So depends on the point of view on how that approach is going to play out. But regardless, I think the internal resources are going to be thin. What that means is that, the particular role that CMS would play in this is something that I am kind of curious to understand. So it's not entirely clear from the outset what it is, but if it's a thin staffed sort of model, then for sure there's going to be a lot of industry participation and involvement in this. That
Yeah, I
would be
would
really.
anticipate there will be anyway, hoping that industry self-regulates is, like that's not a great hope. It is what it is, but hey, I'm not going to get into that part of it. But I wanted to talk to you about it because I think you were you did something similar around trying to build out a service for people where they could have like where they could unify their medical records. Is that right?
So, if you think about like, everyone, like, okay, let's go back historically, right? Like Kaiser Permanente was one of the first integrated healthcare systems that had been very successful on the West Coast, and they moved to the East Coast and they set up like, businesses here, and they've had decent amount of success, but they haven't been as successful as one would expect, right? Because one would expect that an integrated system that has both the health provisioning as well as the insurance pieces, they would have so much better understanding of all of the data, and the coordination would be so much better, and efficiencies because, a lot of 15% of admin, I mean 15% of like a premium dollar is on admin, from a insurance perspective. And I think a similar amount is spent by the providers, right, just to kind of satisfy the needs of the insurance companies, if not more. So there's a lot of like admin waste, if you
Huge,
will, or
huge,
friction, right?
huge amount of administrative inefficiencies in healthcare.
Yeah. So if you even if you say it's like, let's say 20% of like all the premium dollars, that's massive amount, like close to $1 trillion if of opportunity. So if you at the macro level, at the micro level, like you would think somebody like a Kaiser would be so much more efficient because they can squeeze that out. And if you look at industry margins, they're in the single digits. So like if you know they could easily be double the margins of any other player easily, right? Just by squeezing that out. But and I think they're probably they probably perform better. But at the same time, it's not something that's so lucrative that they could just spread out and kind of like capture the entire market, right? So that was one data point where like this integration of the data stuff we'd seen. And then when I was part of Highmark, where we were trying to buy, kind of purchase a healthcare system, a health system, and compete with another sort of player in the market, in the local market called UPMC, that was basically a conglomerate that had hospital systems. They started as a hospital system and they bought up other provider assets, and then they also started a plan, health plan, right? So when we kind of look at those kinds of organizations, what I noticed was there were a lot of regulatory sort of like demarcations between providers and payers that actually made it difficult to have a full integration. So that was one of my experiences. So you could actually share the data as freely as you would have thought. But I mean, obviously, once you de-identify data, you can do it. And the example of that was with Optum. So Optum actually built a business where we had access to data that was from the EHR medical records, which is on the provider side. And then they were able to match that up on a de-identified basis with payer data, kind of create these longitudinal records. So that was my kind of like second experience with that. And then the kind of the consumer side of things was there was a company that I was advising and I had also invested in called I mean, maybe before I kind of like get more into it, like I should say, even when I was at Optum, for example, there was an initiative where they would say like, let's create a consumer-driven health record company, right? And let's create an app that kind of lets consumers kind of manage their own data. And then they did that initiative and didn't really work out as planned. So when I met an entrepreneur who'd already kind of invested in creating such an app called Empowered Health, so I kind of, as I said, I invested with them and I started to help out with a lot of the strategy work with them. As I was doing that, I was I kind of went deep into that space. So what's happened was there was a movement towards health information exchanges, right? So the idea was there's a coordination of care problem, and there was need to have like state level HIEs, as I call them, health information exchanges. And that exchange of information was from provider to provider mainly, and sometimes between payers and providers. But that was then kind of thought of being expanded into making it much more easy for like consumers to get access to data. And there was a lot of initiatives around that from, I think, the previous administrations. It's been around for a while. I think it's not, like one administration versus the other. I think that's been a continuous trend. But like when we started to kind of tap into that data source, we kind of realized it's not easy because, you could get access to it as a provider, but as a consumer to get it, there were lots and lots of barriers, right? And so what Empowered Health did was basically connect their apps onto the CMS data sources, which had mostly the Medicare data and the Medicaid data. So as long as the Medicare data is concerned, like we could get access to it and show it to a consumer on the app. So that was possible. But the moment they had touch points outside of that system, Medicaid systems, then that data would be missing, right? So that still didn't satisfy a lot of the consumers, right? Because, excuse me, because they wanted a kind of complete unified data set that the individual could own. And our vision was that we want every individual to own their own data and manage their own data, and have ownership over the data. Because the funny thing in healthcare is like in the current state, like I'll give you my personal example. My son had a health condition. So we would have to go from one specialist to another place and so on. So when we had to move across, that specialist, oftentimes they couldn't get that data record transferred to them very easily, even after we give them access permissions or consent. But so we would end up carrying like large files, printed paper, all of that, and then we would say, look, here it is, use this. And the funniest thing was my wife was bemoaning this recently. One of the times we actually gave them a full stack of like the folder with all the records, and they kept it. And then when we said, hey, can we have it back? They're like, oh no, our policy doesn't let you have the information back unless you pay us like 80 cents like a page or something. I'm like, wait, we gave you this thing and you give it back to us? And so that was the kind of situation that people deal with. And I think it's the same problem on the physician side, right? Because they have a limited window to see a patient. Like, you've got to put yourself in their shoes. They have like a limited amount of time. They may have a nurse practitioner or whatever people helping them, assistant helping them, but they have a volume of patients, and they're getting a bunch of information, and they have to like quickly process all of that and make sense out of it, and then have an intelligent conversation with the parent. And do the right diagnosis. It's pretty hard. I mean, of course, they're trained for years, which obviously is great, but it's still like humanly, it's super difficult to do that, right? So I think there are inherent issues with the way the system is right now, and Empower was trying to do that with the app, where all of this data would sync in. And the good thing is there are some interoperability protocols, right, like FHIR, HL7, and so on, and that made at least kind of like the mapping of different data from different sources somewhat easy. But even within that, like there's so many assumptions around normalization that has to happen, that you really get down to the level of detail, then you realize, well, it's not quite normalized. You can't quite match these two things. And when you match them, what does it really mean? A whole bunch of questions are unanswered, and it's even with the kind of the FHIR standards and everything they have.
Yeah, no, and I mean, there's, and I mean, like the problem is huge, and it to like to your point, it's yeah, it inhibits care, right? It inhibits the ability to actually get care because, you got to think like, and when I think about it, like I had my pediatrician, from when I was a kid. I don't know where any of those records are. They've probably all been destroyed because they only need to keep them for 7 years, right? So, and that was in the days before everything was in any, most things were in an EHR. That was physical paper, right? So for older folks, they're just like, SOL for a lot of this because it was never digitized. I remember I was looking at buying a medical practice at one point and they had like seven storage units full of old records that they had to keep for a certain amount of time. It being like it, and so like there's actually a physical record problem, right? Before the digitization part, right? And then all the EHRs are different. And there's a million EHRs out there, right? You have the Epics of the world, the big ones, but they all have, like, to your point, none of their data's in standardized ways. They all only have a small piece of it. Then all your insurance providers have some of it, but not all of it. They just generally have the stuff that your provider needs to submit the claim, and they have that record. But if you've changed insurance companies like United and Blue Cross don't talk to each other or give records across, right? So all of that stuff is all isolated. CMS has a whole bunch, massive amounts of data, but it's only on Medicare and Medicaid. And so there is no unified source. It's really difficult to unify it all because none of the data is standardized, right? Truthfully, no one-to-one standardization. So there's like the problem about healthcare data is crazy. And then to like they won't give it to us, like to me as a consumer, they won't give me the data that they have on me either. So yeah, I mean it's a massive problem that inhibits care.
I mean, one of the things which is not obvious to people is they think like, okay, look, we have Epic as one of the biggest systems in many, many or most hospitals right now, and they're very dominant. That should solve the problem, right? But if you look at the initiative, the CMS White House initiative that was launched, I don't see Epic on that. You know
No.
what I mean? Number one. Number two, even if Epic was on it, what we realized was when we try to sync between two hospitals within the same hospital system, right? The current hospital system, there are two different individual hospitals. And they have different instances of Epic, I mean, different versions of Epic. And when you have different words, they don't necessarily sync up between each other, right?
The VA's been going through this for years right now, trying to output to build. It was like the VA, I mean, VA is a great example. They should be unified, right? So like all those systems should talk to each other first. But second, in my mind, like the easiest way is like you think about a active duty military member. There's DHA that's doing all of their healthcare when they're on active duty. That system should be the same, or should be able to talk to the VA system, so you don't need to. So the records, when you either exit, or when you ETS, or retire, what have you, however it is, that information should automatically roll over to the VA. But like the VA, I mean, I think 2 years ago, like the Congress froze multiple contracts for, I think it was Cerner, Oracle Cerner, that they're rolling out because they were just so expensive and not solving the actual problem, right? So even like the government can't do it internally. And then I would assume that Epic is not always, I mean, I would assume it's cloud-based now, but I'm assuming that there's probably still some on-prem
They probably have some
instances out
still.
there. And like just because you're with Epic doesn't mean that like all of the Epic, like just they're not all, it's not like all in one unified database for Epic that you're all going to, right?
I mean, even with Epic, I want to talk about that, and I'll kind of switch to a couple of other topics. Just on the Epic piece, I feel like obviously in the industry, Epic has a pretty, a bad rap because they've been dominant, but they've also been kind of like a walled garden sort of an approach. Like they don't want to let other people come in and play with them. And even in times when they have, like they created this Epic Orchard or whatever, right? Like App Store sort of a model a while ago. And even when people were featured on that and they were on it, it was still kind of like the Amazon Prime sort of issue, Amazon Prime sort of problem, right? Like where Amazon would basically look at some of the most popular products and then create an Amazon's Choice or some version of it, and that would be cheaper and kind of more convenient and better integrated, and they will just use it. So kind of like the same thing has happened in the past, and it's continuing to happen right now. The recent huge kind of news, I don't know if you've tracked, but a lot of the AI companies which are doing ambient listening and scribing, they had like a lot of good funding. They'd gained traction. Lots of physicians were very excited about it because it's kind of like invisible. It lets them interact with their patient, but it would still listen and kind of help with any of the downstream work that has to happen. And so that was a big category, obviously. And Epic basically announced that they're going to do it. And now all of a sudden, the valuation of these startups went down significantly because almost like Epic waited for this model to be proven out. And they're like, okay, cool. Now we can just introduce it within our EHR, which is fully integrated or whatever, right? I mean, yes, there's probably more convenient because it's better integrated, but then if you're looking at it from a government perspective, from an overall system efficiency perspective, they're not necessarily aiding that, right? So they're working in their own in their own selfish interest, which again, as a company, you can't blame them for doing that. But on the other hand, it's not furthering the system for anyone. So that's a problem. But where I really wanted to go was with like two ideas, right? One is all of this data in Epic or any of the EHR systems is geared towards like two things, right? I think I would say mostly all of the codes that are there are geared towards getting reimbursed from the insurance companies, right? So it's not necessarily like a purely from a clinical lens. So this is where I bring in this concept of jobs to be done, right? Like you might have heard of this phrase, jobs to be done, and there's like a whole body of literature around jobs to be done. So we look at it as jobs to be done. We got to be very deliberate on like what are the jobs to be done with this data. So it's not like data is not data. Data is just a means to get some jobs done. And depending on the job to be done, the same data could be captured and represented and transferred in a certain way, right? There is a certain structure to it. And the biggest problem for us is like the jobs to be done is not clearly delineated and demarcated. So like people end up taking the nearest variable, nearest data set that somehow indicates something that's close to the jobs to be done, but it's not designed for the job to be done. So that's number one. That's a huge problem. And number two is what I would call as like what is the role? Like, if let's say you have the White House or the CMS convening something, what is the role that they're trying to play? Like, are they trying to play the role of a convener who's basically setting certain standards for data to be useful and then letting all the players kind of converge towards like capturing and interoperating on that on that data? If that's the role they're playing, I mean, then it's there's one kind of work to be done. If instead they're looking at themselves as people who gather all the data and protect and manage the data, that's a different role to be played, right? And then there could be a third role where it's a referee role where they're just like making sure like, hey, this is meant to be interoperable, but it's not. Let's go fix it, right? So I think there are multiple roles that can potentially play up. So I'm not clear what the exact role is going to be, but I think if they try to role play the role of like bringing all the data together and managing it, I think it's a much harder, more difficult, intensive problem. I think there are smarter ways to do it where like they could leverage the industry for what it's already doing in their own self-interest and figure out ways to align those interests rather than kind of pull everything and try to remanage that whole data stream. It's kind of like my personal view, just given how complex it is, right? Even companies like Optum, which is the largest, a large part of the largest healthcare company in America, or I don't know if they're the largest or is CVS Aetna the larger? I need to check. But
They're
regardless,
both Fortune 10 companies, I think. So
right?
it's like, I
Top
mean, at
three,
that point,
right? So even if a company like that, when they have a commercial offering out of this integrated data set that we had, and millions of dollars of business, even with that, like I knew how difficult it was for us to manage and have like good quality data. If that's the case, I can only imagine like how hard it is to do it, do what like CMS is trying to do right now with this initiative. And I think you'd increase your chance of success if you. If you kind of like basically play the convener sort of role rather than like, the data gatherer and management of the data itself, because gathering and managing the data is a nightmare.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That, oh no, it absolutely is. Absolutely massive. And then, I mean, if that's the way that they end up going, then it brings in a whole bunch of privacy concerns, right? And like, I can't even imagine the difficulty that would be associated with matching, like standardizing all of that data, right? How do you even begin? Like, I don't know, how would you even begin to standardize that much data across that many sources that comes in so many disparate ways? I that just
Look,
like that
Empowered.
problem boggles my mind, right? Like,
Empowered had spent millions of dollars in doing that, right? Like, so we had the methodology doing it. Like there are companies who can. I mean, I'm not just trying to kind of promote like Empowered Health, but I'm just saying there are lots of companies who have figured that part out or know pretty deep stuff around how that is done. So I don't think it's not doable, but just managing like that whole process, is very difficult because you're talking about kind of keeping so many different entities to be sending information in a particular way, and I think just managing that is a full-time job versus like actually normalizing the data and providing it to the kind of patients, for example, can be done really well by app companies like Empower and others. There are lots of companies who can do that piece really well, so I don't think I would say the government should spend time figuring that out because that's already figured out. There are multiple flavors based on. So, for example, like there are apps that could take that data and provide it in a certain way that's useful for the diabetics, right? And there are apps that could use that same data and provide it as being useful for some sort of chronic care, for example, of some nature, or for emergency use, so on and so forth. So there are many ways in which that data can be used. I think the problem is like nobody knows how data from Epic and data from this other peer, they how they're comparable, and kind of figuring that out has been the biggest nightmare. So I think even setting some standards, setting the table on what that commonality is where the real energy has to be spent, if you ask me. And if that can be done and we can make sure that people are not playing games in terms of sharing their data, Like if you just do those two functions, I think we could all have a big win.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. I think, but yeah, I think giving people the opportunity to have access to all of their medical data is a game changer, especially when you start looking at how people are using AI to help diagnose themselves and understand themselves and their issues at a more personalized healthcare level, right? Obviously, you should still run anything by a doctor, of course, like an MD or a DO or somebody that's gone to school and licensed and because again, like we were saying earlier, AI is going to make mistakes. But it's it, that being said, like if you could put all of this data into individuals' hands, I think on in like individual level, then you have the opportunity to use it in a way that it has never been able to be used before.
Yeah. And I think the other thing which gets missed out in these conversations is something somewhat more nuanced, which is like, what is like, who sees what data, right? So you might say, look, any healthcare data what you is yours, right? Like personally. And that would have been my attitude as well until I kind of found out, wait, that's not entirely true, because there are going to be situations where like the physician wants to make certain notes and doesn't want to expose it to the patient, right? Like there are going to be real use cases where that happens. So you want to have systems which like allow certain things to be kind of kept just to the physician. And it, like those should be far and few, few and far between, right? Like I'm not saying that should be rampant, but there should be an option for the physician. And there are, I mean, many of these health record systems have that sort of feature. But that has to be incorporated into this kind of data sharing as well, right? So you want to make sure that like if there is a particular thing which is very sensitive and it's not something you want to alarm the patient with at a certain point. I mean, not saying the patient should never have access, but even like during a certain treatment course, the physician should have the ability to make some notes and keep that to themselves, even if it's a hypothesis or whatever,
Right.
of like freaking people out and making it even worse for them. Right. So there are going to be a good number of those situations. And I think vice versa, there's going to be situations where the consumer wants to have certain notes about their health and they don't want to put it in their own layman's language and for some physician to misinterpret it and say, wait, this is what's happening. I'm going to put you on like on surgery, right? Like you don't want them, like I think there should be safeguards on both sides. So the system that should evolve is where there's going to be a whole body of data that's like very much transferable for various entities. And again, I think it depends on what entity. Like, insurance companies should have only access to certain things, right? Which again, we have all that kind of structures in place. So it gets very complex on from that perspective. But I think this idea of a unified health record as a single data set which just moves around is fiction, right? It doesn't exist because there are all these things that I just mentioned to you, like, there are like, there's going to be a full body of data, but then there's going to be some versions of it that's going to be visible or applicable to somebody and others. So having just figuring that out is pretty complex.
Yeah, it absolutely is. But when you if something like this got, say theoretically, it's done and it's and there is a unified medical record for every person in the country, what kind of benefits would that have beyond like I mean like for research, because it would be more unified data standardized, like how could that something like that benefit?
I mean, look, I mean, there's massive benefits, right? And especially in the age of AI, because now, like, when you have a massive data set without AI, there's only so much you can do with it. With AI, you can do a lot more, right? So that right there, you have some benefits. So I would say number one, from a patient perspective, I think it improves the patient experience like by multifold, right? It probably reduces a lot of anxiety. Reduces a lot of like back and forth stuff that people end up doing. So like simple things like reconciling clinical stuff with the billing stuff is a massive pain for people. And the worst thing is it happens exactly at the time when you're dealing with a difficult medical condition and when you have to also deal with this kind of nightmare of like what are you getting billed for, what procedures you had, what was the clinical need for it, like can you challenge some of that billing or not? Like, you've no energy, if you're in a serious medical condition to do any of that, but that's exactly when you have to do it. So, that's just from a patient perspective, right? I mean, obviously, to say the least, about like better outcomes for the patient, it's massive. For the
Oh.
providers, again, it's a nightmare. I discussed this with you briefly, right? Like, they have whatever, like 20 minutes for a primary care visit, or maybe longer if it's a specialist visit. But there's still very limited amount of time, and they want to be able to kind of get a full picture of what's going on. And oftentimes they don't see some lab results that were done in some other lab, and they were not part of this record, and the patient forgot to mention that. You know what I mean? There's so much missing information, and they have they are liable to be sued, right? I mean, if they make a mistake. And so I think it'll be massively beneficial for physicians and providers in general. And from an insurance industry perspective, I think there is, again, a lot of benefits, right? Like a lot of the medical policies driven by like these kinds of dynamics. Like they are trying to be overly conservative because they don't have the data, or they're trying to be inaccurate in terms, they end up being inaccurate. I mean, they're not trying to be, they end up being inaccurate because they didn't have the right information when they set medical policy. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff from an insurance perspective. And then, as you rightly said, from a research perspective, it's a gold mine. I mean, NHS recently, I think, was kind of like, there's a professor by name Tyler Cowen in George Mason. So he was talking to NHS, and he was like basically saying, look, your biggest advantage you have as a country is your NHS data. Like, it's a unified like national health record system that can be mined for a lot of health improvements. So it becomes kind of the greatest source of healthcare data. And obviously UK has different populations, they're very diverse. So you could actually help a variety of populations across the world using that data, and want to find a way to take advantage of it. And I think it's probably even more true in the US, right? Like in the US, it's much better than, if it's done well, it's much more valuable than what NHS has.
Well, yeah, more people, right? Like, four, isn't the US have like four times the population of the UK ish?
Yeah, I think four is probably 4 to 5 times.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, and it's, yeah, I mean, I think it's like 70 million versus 340 million. So, that's pretty big. It's a pretty big delta, right? But it's also like it's a much larger scale. Like the problem is much larger is the scale of it's bigger, but also like England has had a unified health system for, I don't know, 60, 70 years now. I think it went into effect in the 50s or 60s. I don't really know, but I think it was post World War II. Whereas we have no standardization, nothing. But it's also like, like when you think about data, like, the US Census is a great, great source of data, right? We conducted our first census in 1790 and have done one every 10 years since then, right? So you look at, I mean, that's 250 years of data. Consistently, every 10 years, you have a same snapshot, same data point. So we have a lot of really good data on that. I would assume same thing, like UK, they have a lot of good data on their population because, even, I don't know what their record storage policies are, but as soon as they have the digital storage, like I would assume that they're not really going to delete a whole bunch of it. I don't know their policies in depth. But like if we had that kind of medical record system for say 100 years of the US's that like that gives us so much more data and gives us the opportunity to your point to draw conclusions and to look at things in different ways. And maybe it would have been clumsy at first, but now like it would be accelerating things like health research in ways that we just don't have data sets for.
Yeah, and I think there are a couple of interesting things as well, right? Like, because in the US, there have been such diversity in how the health is managed, because of different health systems, different insurance companies, policies, and so on. I think you have a much richer data set, I would argue, because at least in the UK, it's going to be more consistent, versus here, there are more diverse. But obviously have, the sample set is bigger, right? It's like 5 times or 4 times bigger than what the UK has. So with a higher sample set, but with lots of variation, you may actually be able to do a lot more with the research. And as you were talking, I kind of realized, wait, with AI, I mean, right now there are still reliability issues. There are lots of problems with AI. But in the future, you may be able to go back and just relook at all of this data. So even if you haven't figured it out yet, let's say hypothetically 5 to 10 years from now, you have AI that could actually go and like normalize, do all of the things that we just discussed on its own, or maybe with some level of human aid. So even if we don't end up solving it now, I think we still have the prospect of AI helping us solve it in the future. And so this data is still going to be valuable, is my contention.
It just depends on when it's going to be valuable and when we will be able to use it. And I love, I do love, like, I think, another point, not, you brought it up, but it's, like, the UK's population is just like a lot more homogenous, right? They're more the same, whereas people can't come here from all over the world. And so you have, like, it's a much more representative sample of the entire world from a health data a health data perspective than I would say any other country. Like, we have people from all over the world that come here, and they're going to have different issues, right? Like, and I think that, like, when you talk about, like, stereotyping folks, we're looking at, like, that might not be the right word, but looking at people, like, they're stereotypes for a reason, and they're going to be like different people from different parts of the world, who grew up with different diets and in different ways are going to have, tendencies or towards, different kinds of diseases and different kind of genetic, there'd be a lot of, and so having all of that, would be really cool for researching, like, some of the more rare diseases, but also, like, the common cold that we still haven't killed. We haven't figured out how to cure that. Or, you look at some of these, I mean, I won't even get into vaccines and all of that, and how we could use AI to potentially, like, build hyper personalized medicine for your individual biology, and you can only do that with data on you, right? Like, so I think, like, all that stuff would be really cool, but it's just not, we're not there yet.
Yeah, I mean, I was about to say that even though you're saying you're like stereotyping, I mean, the purpose of stereotyping is just make basically sense making, pattern recognition, right? Like that's the whole point of stereotyping, I think. I mean, it's the legitimate reason for stereotyping, I would say. And with AI, you don't need to do that as much anymore, right? Because you don't need to generalize. You're only generalizing because you can't handle the variation in complexity and the data behind it, but with AI you can potentially do that. So I feel like you get the same benefits of the stereotyping thing that you're mentioning, which is like some kind of pattern recognition, but you can do it pretty micro levels, like to the extent like okay, like look, let's say like I grew up in India and there are like a few other people who are there, but my diet may still be varied than theirs because of whatever reason, be my personal choices or whatever, right? Like AI should be able to see that, right? Like they should say, well, yeah, if I'm looking at diet as a factor, then I should not exclude, I mean, I should not include both these people in the same data set, right? Even though they might appear to have similar, diets, they don't actually don't because I have some other data that shows that, person wasn't following the typical diet of some of the other people from that region or whatever, right? So I think that kind of stuff becomes very exciting and valuable from a data standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, I mean, you look at also, like, how people grow up, where they grow up, like, water quality, right? Access to clean water, that's a huge part of it, right? And your how does the immune system develop in ways where you don't have access to clean, like, as clean water as, say, we do here, right? Well, outside of, like, places like Flint, Michigan, but we're not talking about them. nobody's talking about them anymore. But again, you start looking at these things, and it's like, dude, there has to be a way, if we can build this map, if we can actually use this data set, there has to be so many ways that we can use it to really push public health forward, right? And so, like, I think, like, I'm doing a big project, and I think I've told you, in a large municipality's wastewater plants right now, right? And I was thinking about, like, that specifically, and how that's downstream from most things, right? Wastewater is downstream from most things, but it's upstream from, like, pandemic, from, like, diseases, right? You can get an understanding of people's, of the health of the population that the wastewater plant services by sampling and running tests on all the waste as it comes through. That's upstream from, potentially from new pandemics, from new diseases. How could we integrate that, testing into there, right? And then understand that's also additional location data that you can then pull into a massive data set like this and have an understanding of not just, historically where you're from, but also what should you be looking out for in the environment that you're in, how healthy is the area you're living in. And then I think, like, at a macro level, you could potentially go in and, like, try to come in and solve some of those problems before they actually happen, right? Because I think predicting an individual's healthcare or state of their healthcare is not easy. That's hard, right? For one person. But when you're looking at a 300 million people, that becomes much easier because there's so many more of them, as long as you have the right data and the right tools to analyze the data.
Yeah, very much true. I mean, I think the one thing that we didn't touch on is this whole, you alluded to it a little bit, which is that, how would there be trust issues with government, kind of managing this sort of unified data set or whatever that's being, kind of envisioned right now. And I think, I would say there was a recent big scare in the healthcare industry last year with a company called Change Healthcare, which was bought by Optum eventually. But Change Healthcare had, I mean, I think right after their acquisition, they had a massive data breach issue and hacking sort of problem. And that basically put everything on a standstill for a bunch of other players in the industry, right? And that really damaged the reputation for Optum and UnitedHealth Group in the eyes of these other players in the industry. And that wasn't, I mean, again, that was still like one company, right? So if you can imagine that happening at the national level, it's massively dangerous and scary, and it could, actually reduce trust even more in the future if, something like that happens, right? So how do we guard against that is the big question. So the one way to guard against that is to basically still have localized data sets that are managed separately by different entities, but then have a way to kind of connect them at the point of a request, right? Like a individual asks for the data or a particular system asks for an individual's data. Is there a way to bring that together in real time in a manner that doesn't compromise? I mean, you don't need to hold that data all in one place. The data can still be in different places, but can you pull it together as needed in a rapid manner? Approaches like that could be very helpful. And obviously there's a lot of problems with being able to do that, right? I mean, the speed at which this kind of data can be processed, managed, there's a whole slew of issues. But approaches like that have to be, considered even as you go into any kind of initiatives like this, because I mean the risk of having all of the data in one place is just too high in sort of environment.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I completely agree with you, and I think that, I think that especially in today's day and age, there's a lot of distrust of the government, and rightfully so. When you look at a lot of the policies that have happened over the last, and I don't care who you vote for, like, you look at the policies over the last, call it 25 years, like, there's a lot of, I mean, fuck, call it 50 years, there's a lot of reasons not to trust the government, going back to things like, like Iran, the Iran-Contra stuff. Like, you look at a lot of the research that was, like, the really, like, off the chain research that they were doing on pop on the US population 50 and 60 years ago, and I'm sure to some extent still are. You look at all these things, and, like,
You
there's
won't find out
reasons
in
to.
another 50 years when something's declassified, right? Like you won't know until then.
But I think that, all of that being said, I think that this, like, is a national resource that should be set up and put in a put to in a position to be used to advance the to advance the health of the country and of the world. But if the government doesn't do it, nobody will, right? Like, there's nobody, like, because, I mean, you look at these private corporations, they're not going to invest a whole bunch of money into this. Like, they're just not going to do that. This is something that should be done. And, like, I'm a big believer in, like, right sizing government. Like, I think government obviously has gotten very, very large in a lot of ways. And I think that it doesn't matter who's elected, the government continues to expand. I'm a fan of right sizing, like, right sizing care, and, like, looking at things like that the government should do. And I think things like this are things that the government should be involved in, which are
Yeah,
initiatives
100%.
for the betterment of the population at large that nobody else is going to do.
You know, I 100% agree. I think there is a role for government, which, you know, kind of like is about this sort of coordination issue, if you will. And I think this is a fantastic example of that. But I still like, you know, I'm in huge admiration for like how, you know, the US was created and how the framers of the Constitution were very enlightened in terms of like, they were not naive in terms of institutional issues, right? Like they were like, oh, you want to have checks and balances. You want to expect that, you know, politicians and, you know, entities, be it government or private or whatever, would have their own interests. They're going to pursue their own interests. So knowing all that, how do you design a system that despite them having those interests, you know, we don't get screwed, right? So I think that sort of enlightened thinking is what I think is really needed. So it's not so much about like, you know, how much money you spend from the government and how big of a role you play, but it's like bringing in that sort of enlightened approach saying, look, you would expect, you know, private entities to insurance companies to resist this and not do that. You would expect epics to behave in a certain way. Like, you know, this is all just normal stuff. Like, you know, it's not like, you know, in this system, that's how they would behave. Like now, given that they do behave this way, what do we need to do, right? Like, what's the best path forward? Like that kind of thinking, I think, you know, no private sector company is going to do, right? Because that's, you know, that's not their job. But yeah, a government entity can definitely put in that sort of thinking, right? And it's almost like, you know, like I always go back to the framers of the Constitution, framers of the founding of the country, like where they're like they really gave it like some really strategic thought and long-term thought. So like, how is this gonna, I mean, you know, I don't know, like, you know, how successful they are, but at least they gave it some thought and they were not naive about it, right? So that's why that I really appreciate. And I think that sort of non-naive sort of design is what we really need. And oftentimes when you do it that way, it's not expensive. Like, you know, you don't have to spend a lot of money doing it. You just need to be smart about it.
Yeah, no, and I mean, like, I'm with you. I think that, like, the Constitution was framed and set up really, really well. I think that the fact that we're still here 250 years later is a testament to that. I think that democracy is the least bad form of government that we've found. My main problem with democracy is the people that end up in power are the ones that want power.
That's
Right,
right.
like, you know, you're not gonna, and you know, you have to decide to run for Congress and put your like you don't like n most people aren't gonna do that. You know, I certainly have no interest in all that in political theater and the games and this. Like, no, like, let's just have a conversation about getting things done. You know, but it's better than a like a you know a monarchy where it's just like a roll of the dice. Maybe this kid will be good, and you know, who knows? Maybe they'll be a crazy person, and you know, who just you have no idea. You know, and you look at all like it's a really interesting, but I think that, you know, right sizing government, finding the place, things that they like I said that they should be doing things like this. You know, I applaud the initiative from the administration. I'm really curious to see how it's going to turn out and how it's going to work out, because at the end of the day, this is something that we could actually save lives with by implementing properly. And you know, like, that's what we should be doing and looking at is how do we take better care of ourselves and our citizens.
And I think unless we've had these conversations, right? Like, I mean, regardless of what government is or whatever, like if regular people and informed people in the country and in the market, unless they're having these kind of conversations and pushing whatever decision is done, regardless of political ideology or theater, like we push for the right things. It's you know, that's the only way things get done, right? Because if we don't push for it, like who else would, right? Like if you're not having these kinds of podcasts and conversations, how will this information like come out, or who's going to put pressure on the people making decisions, like, or who's even going to inform the people making decisions? Oftentimes, like, it's not even pressure. I mean, oftentimes they don't know, right? Like, you know, people making decisions have a bunch of things going on, and they are listening to the nearest lobbyist, to the nearest, you know, company that's talking to them. Like, you know, what else can you do? I mean, you have only 8 hours in your day. Like, you're going to listen to people who are around you, and the people come around to talking to you are the ones who have the vested interest anyway. So it's just a very natural problem. So, and I think this sort of citizen dialogue or kind of like industry dialogue is what I think could give a much better view, and more of these views are kind of circulated and kind of made available to people in decision making or even influence, right? I think the better. So I think it's fantastic. I mean, we are doing our job.
I appreciate you coming on and having the conversation. It's yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Is there anything else you'd like to add in it before we wrap up?
No, I think this is like there's a lot of things in AI, I would say, that are now starting to happen. And one of the things that like I'll just kind of end with in a little bit of like promotion, if you will, not promotion, but like an idea, right? Like I mean, because I don't have a way to commercialize this yet. But one thing that's kind of emerging is that a lot of the companies in healthcare and probably outside of healthcare as well are struggling with hundreds of AI companies coming in and saying, oh, we could do this for you, we could do that for you. And they have no way to kind of like say, wait, what works, what doesn't work, what should we do, what we shouldn't do, what are our internal constraints and what are not our internal constraints. And just having a clear understanding of like what's a good benchmark even, right? Like knowing that, okay, for the kinds of stuff we need to do in healthcare, these are the kinds of benchmarks we need to have. And any vendor or any technology that kind of meets this benchmark, we want to consider seriously and then look to integrate or whatever. There is no map of the world from an AI perspective for these companies. So one of the initiatives that I've been kind of more and more getting involved with, and people are saying you should do something about it, is to kind of create a sort of I don't know what you want to call it, a center of excellence or some sort of organization that is across the industry or across a sector of the industry. Could be just for hospitals, for example, or for physicians or whatever, for specialties. We could kind of drill it down as much as you want, but having some sort of a group where we kind of like set some of those standards or set some of those benchmarks and ideas for AI to be adopted more efficiently is massively needed. And I think there's a growing interest in that kind of stuff. So that's where I'm starting to spend a little bit of time these days. So I just wanted to put that plug in there, and that if other people are interested in this topic and we want to have a conversation, I would be very open to it and be looking forward to it. And I think there's a lot of opportunity that would come from it from a commercial perspective as well. But I think first and foremost, we need to set the intellectual sort of foundation for all of that. And that's where I'm starting to spend a lot of time.
Yeah, man, I love it. Love to be involved. Love to have you back to talk about that again some other time. I think it's really, really interesting because I agree that there's a lot. It's a very noisy space. There's a lot of stuff going on, and generally, I look at whenever I'm thinking about anything AI related, I look and see what somebody was doing in like 2017. For what were you doing for a living in 2017, 2018? Like 5 or 8 years ago, before ChatGPT 3.5 came out. And if you weren't like in the AI space, I would immediately discount a lot of what you say because you haven't been doing it, and you're just riding a bandwagon. So it's really interesting, interesting space, interesting times. And healthcare, really interesting topic. And thanks so much for joining today, man. It's been a great time.
That's great. I think I enjoyed the interview. I mean, like we have one-on-one conversations which are equally interesting, but obviously I think we were able to pack all of those and more in this time here on the podcast. So kudos to you for running the podcast so nicely.
Oh, man, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. If anybody wants to talk to Anoop, his contact information or his LinkedIn is going to be in the description below. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Robots and Red Tape, and I hope you're all having a great day.